will witness the day of the pride of all the nations in the region and their victory against the child-killing regime of Israel. These huge crimes should never be forgotten, and 16th of June should be forever remembered on the calendar, because it will be the start and the beginning of a global movement. Well, of course, in a symbolic way, we are going to, in the presence of our foreign media journalists and also members of the families of the martyrs, they are going to come and sign this text that we have prepared for this day to be named as the Day of Terrorism Against Media Members and Terrorism Against Journalism.
Nowruzi, in his remarks, called for June 16th, the day the Israeli regime targeted the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting, to be registered internationally as a day against terrorism on media workers. He also honored all media workers, especially those killed in Gaza, as martyrs in the path of struggle against imperialism. Nowruzi emphasized that Israel had been compelled to treat the media as an independent eighth front in its operations, describing this as a point to be proud of. He also expressed gratitude to the international journalists who traveled to Iran to show their solidarity with their Iranian colleagues. A group of foreign journalists have come to Iran for a first-hand coverage of the aftermath of the recent Israeli strikes on Tehran, challenging claims that the attacks only targeted military sites. On the fourth day, the delegation visited the Iranian broadcast headquarters building, known as the Glass Building, which was destroyed in the Israeli attack. Our correspondent, Gisu Misha Ahmadi, talked to us earlier from the site. Let's see what she had to say.
Today, on the fourth day, as you mentioned yourself, they are visiting the IRIB glass building. And as you can see, this is what's left of the building. We had reported this. We are quite familiar with this scene, what is left of the IRIB headquarters, known as the glass buildings, attacked. And actually, the news was being broadcast live at the time of the Israeli attack. So the journalists are now right here, and they've had the chance to talk to the news anchor, Ms. Sahar Emami, who was actually reading the news at the time when the Israeli attack happened. And this is the studio which was attacked at that time during the live broadcast. And the journalists, as you can see, if you can come along with me and see, this is what's left of that studio. And the result of the Israeli attack, the huge material damage that has been done to the glass building and to the main studio of Iran's IRIB news network.
As Sudan's own war drags into its third year, many people in Khartoum are getting inspired by a distant confrontation. Iran's bold and punitive response to the Israeli aggression is striking a chord with Sudanese citizens, many of whom see parallels between foreign occupation and the destruction brought by Sudan's own internal conflict. In a country where resistance has long shaped national identity, Iran's stance is being watched not with indifference, but with quiet recognition. Abdullah Hussein reports from Khartoum.
In the midst of hunger, shelling and displacement, many in the Sudanese capital Khartoum still find time to follow the world beyond Tehran's resoluteness against Israel in a region where others have chosen silence or normalization with the oppressive regime is sparking something deeper here in Sudan. It's personal. This is the same city where after the 1967 Arab-Israeli war, leaders gathered and declared the three no's, no peace, no recognition, and no negotiations with Israel. That legacy still lingers in the hearts of many Sudanese, not just as a political stance, but as a matter of principle and pride. Despite the struggle for daily survival, from finding food to fleeing violence, Sudanese civilians remain emotionally engaged in what they see as a larger fight for justice. The cause of Palestine still holds symbolic weight, and Iran's bold posture doesn't go unnoticed. Just as Israel is seen as an occupying force in Palestine, the RSF is seen here as an internal invader, a militia turning cities into battlefields. For people caught between rappel and ration lines, resistance anywhere feels like something worth noticing. We followed closely the missiles Iran launched at Israel to defend itself, which is a legitimate threat. Israel is supported by countries like the U.S. and European countries.
We followed the Israeli attacks on Iran, a sovereign and respected country. This aggressive regime has oppressed the Islamic nation and the Palestinian people. I pray that Allah grants victory to both Iran and the Islamic nations.
Even in a city scarred by war, the echoes of international struggle still reach deeply. Iran's actions remind many Sudanese that silence isn't the only option. Dignity, even under siege, can still speak and be heard. Here in Khartoum, the war is local, but the struggle feels global. As Iran stands its ground and asserts its influence, many Sudanese see a mirror of their own fight, a people refusing to accept silence or submission. Abdullah Hussein from Khartoum.
There is no end in sight to the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza as the regime in Tel Aviv intensifies its indiscriminate attacks across the blockaded territory. In one of the latest strikes, multiple Palestinians were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed the shelter for displaced Palestinians in the Al-Mawasi refugee camp near Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. Fatalities were also reported following Israeli shelling of Palestinian homes in Al-Mashala area of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The attack on Deir al-Balah comes as the regime has issued evacuation orders for parts of the town amid an imminent large-scale ground invasion. The U.S.-Israeli genocide, which began in October 2023, has so far killed nearly 58,900 Palestinians. Almost 141,000 others have been injured. Most of the victims are women and children. Meanwhile, over 100 Palestinian aid seekers have been killed in a single day in Gaza in what many see as Israel's blatant disregard for human rights and international law. According to Gaza's civil defense, Israeli troops opened fire on crowds of Palestinians trying to collect humanitarian aid north of Gaza City on Sunday, killing 86 people and wounding dozens more. 13 others were shot dead near an aid distribution center in Rafah, southern Gaza, while 4 more were killed near another aid site in Khan Yunis, also in the south. According to Gaza's medical sources, the number of casualties in what is known as death traps has reached nearly 1,000 since late May. The sources say all the victims were civilians attempting to access food before the distribution sites were turned into killing zones. They say the aid seekers are targeted in direct sniper and gunfire attacks by Israeli forces in a blatant violation of international humanitarian law and human rights principles. A ship carrying humanitarian activists has departed from Italy's Gallipoli port, aiming once again to challenge the naval blockade of the Gaza Strip.
And all the comrades, we are about to sail to Gaza to challenge the blockade imposed on our brothers and sisters, and to challenge this illegal blockade, but also to say a clear message, to say it clearly and loudly: stop the genocide, stop the illegal blockade, stop using famine as a war weapon.
And I just want you to look at those toys. Who can dare arrest a boat with toys for children? Who can dare arrest a boat with food for children, with baby formula? Because we are talking about that. We are only civilians on a boat to give food and to break an illegal blockade. We are talking about that. We are not dangerous. We are just in the side of humanity.
The Andala, part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, is transporting civilian activists, including lawyers, doctors, and journalists, in a mission of solidarity. Alongside life-saving aid, the group is bringing toys for the children of Gaza, symbolizing hope amid hardship. Last month, another mission led by the Flotilla Coalition aboard the Madleen ship ended with Israeli naval forces seizing the vessel. The United Nations says 69 Palestinian communities have been displaced across the occupied West Bank since Israel's genocidal war on Gaza started in 2023. The UN Humanitarian Office attributed displacements to a sharp increase in Israeli settler violence against Palestinians and movement restrictions. It noted that nearly 2,900 Palestinians have been displaced in less than 2 years. The office emphasized that the intensified settler violence has created intolerable living conditions, forcing Palestinian families to abandon their homes. Around 45% of the displaced families come from Ramallah, followed by Al-Khalil, Bethlehem, Nablus, Tubas, Salfit, Al-Quds, and Ariha. The UN office also documented a surge in settler attacks between July 8th and 14th, reporting at least 30 incidents targeting Palestinian civilians, which resulted in casualties, property damage, or both. The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has reiterated the country's firm stance in supporting the Palestinian people in the besieged Gaza Strip. Abdul Malik al-Houthi emphasized that the Yemeni people will continue their serious and active support for Gaza in all fronts, including through military operations, mobilization, and public campaigns. He described the severe shortage of food and essential aid in Gaza as a horrific tragedy and profound injustice. Houthi warned that people, especially children, are entering the most extreme phase of starvation in Gaza. He condemned Israel for turning aid distribution points into death traps, calling it a part of the regime's genocidal campaign. Houthi also slammed some Arab and Muslim nations for their inaction in the face of mass starvation in Gaza, saying their silence has emboldened Israel and the U.S. to carry out their crimes without any fear of consequences. The leader of Ansar Allah urged all Muslims to mount pressure on Israel to lift the blockade on Gaza. Moving now to Syria, where cautious calm has settled over the southern province of Sweida after days of fierce tribal clashes in the Druze minority region, which left over 1,000 people dead. Reports say fighting stopped on Sunday after Syria's HTS-led regime declared the withdrawal of Bedouins from the Flashpoint city. That following a ceasefire announced on Saturday. Syrian regime's forces have been deployed to the village of Al-Mazra'a near Sweida to block the entry of armed Bedouin tribesmen. Long-running tensions between Druze and Bedouin tribes erupted into clashes a week ago after the abduction of a Druze merchant. Damascus then sent troops to quell the fighting. They, however, were hit by Israeli strikes before withdrawing under a truce agreed on Wednesday. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast round the clock for listeners across the globe. The English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting can be heard via shortwave, internet, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,710 kilohertz every day on 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in the Southern Africa can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 11,740 kilohertz every day on 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Iran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. You can also listen to the radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means.
Thank you.
Fear in my heart, got nothing left to lose. I saw my loved ones die. Oh, I swear that I won't give in. By God, you'll never win. I'll fight for what's right. Nothing can stand in my way. Even if I get knocked down, I will stand my
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this episode of the program Viewpoints with me, Attar, the host of this program. With me in the studio, I have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Hussein and Sister Zainab. Shaykh Hussein, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam to you and to your dear listeners.
And Sister Zainab, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum salam, brother, and also to all our listeners.
Thank you. All right, for today's discussion, I want to talk about the role of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in safeguarding the message of Karbala. Mostly when we get to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, we find that, okay, so during the Karbala Ashura event, he was sick. So that was the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He was sick so that he is safeguarded for the line of Imamat. So Lady Zainab took care of her, of an imam. And then when he is, we can say, getting back to the city, you know, he's in prison, somehow in confinement. And for so many years, he is busy with worshipping. And because he was under control, few were allowed to have contact with him, in fact. But still, the line of Imamat goes on through Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. So, how his supplications, his prayings, his worshipings, he was Sayyidu Sajjadin, you know, the best of the worshippers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. How his worshipping could save the line of Imamat and the Shia legacy. This is a major question for today. Shaykh Hussein, let's start with you. First, give us a picture of Imam Sajjad's role on that time. I mean, especially in the post-Ashura movement.
Yes, when it comes to the time of Imam Sajjad, we should consider certain elements. One of them is that the tragedy of Ashura clearly changed the course of history in both in Islam and in Shia sect. Because we see, this is clear and obvious, that we see the change of the tactics of the Imams. The strategy of Shia, did not change. The strategy of Shia was to revive Muhammadan Islam at whatever cost possible.
All right.
But then the tragedy of Ashura showed that people might not be ready for that form of the revival. And still the Imams, they had their divine mission to carry on. And again, considering the realities on the ground, is that you, after Ashura, you have the uprising of Tawabin.
Yes.
And there are remaining Shias that are killed there. Mm-hmm. And you have other areas that... So she is under severe persecution. And the Imam should virtually start from zero. Mm-hmm. Start building a community.
Yes.
And this takes a while. You see the fruit and the results of the project that Imam Sajjad starts at the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
Yes.
After two generations.
Yes.
When you see that big community of Shia, and now the formation of Shia as a fully fledged sect.
Sorry, Imam al-Baqir was living at the time at the story of Karbala.
Yes, too? He was four.
Oh, he was four.
He was four.
He was
at
present.
The time of Ashura, yes.
So in the caravan that was taken from to Damascus.
Yes. There are reports that he says that I remember something.
Wow.
So yes, Imam Baqir was there.
Mm-hmm. Two imams. So over there.
Yes,
okay. That's it.
And but he was not the immediate issue of Imam Hussein. So you needed Imam Sajjad as the next imam, and then Imam Baqir. So that is the condition when you want to build a community from zero. Another thing is that the propaganda that these people, I mean, the enemy had against the Ahlul Bayt was that these are Kharijat, these are the outlaws, they are out of the fold of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see in the supplications of Imam Sajjad, it's not just a supplication, high-level spiritual teachings.
Yes.
Actually, there's this saying, there's this story, which is a true one. Some people were reciting Dua Khomeini, supplication of Khomeini in Medina. Some people went to these those who were reciting and said, who is this supplication from? And that Shia person who was reciting, he was smart. He says, it must be from Amir al-Mu'mineen. So everybody knew that this kind of knowledge is not normal. Mm-hmm. So with Imam Sajjad also the same. People could instantly realize that these lines come from the house of the prophethood. And those who are accusing these people of rebellion, those people who are accusing these people of being outlaw or kharijat out of the fold of Islam, they're actually having a political agenda.
That's
and
right.
That was very important.
So you mean Imam Sajjad's stance was absolutely right, because the Ahlul Bayt were accused of being outlaws, knowing nothing about Islam. So now through this new corpus that is being made. I mean, supplications, worshipings, and the texts, which were at the beginning in the form of the letters, isn't it?
Some of them.
For example, Resalatul Huquq was in terms. And Resalatul Huquq, really, you know, I'm shocked when I look at the text today, that how much applicable it is today in terms of the neighbors, in terms of the teachers, students, parents, even environment, okay? So body, come on, the rights of the body. And that's great. Okay, so how worshiping and supplication can be used as a shield? I mean, this is really good. I mean, so many times, for example, supplication, worshiping is a personal, individual experience. It has nothing to do with the society. But I think now this time Imam Sajjad gives a new color.
Yeah, and obviously, when we look at what Imam al-Sajjad was doing, we have to, as Sheikh Latifi obviously said, we have to consider that what the role of all the Imams is to obviously safeguard the true Muhammadan Islam and continue that mission, and so that mankind can obviously be brought to salvation. And obviously, the Ahl Bayt have also told us that, for example, no matter how much we love the Ahl Bayt, on Judgment Day, if we just proclaim, oh, but I've always loved the Ahl Bayt, that's not going to be enough. So the Ahl Bayt are also training us to follow the Quran, to follow Allah's commands. That's what they want to see from us. So it's obvious, because we know in the historical context that obviously at the time after Ashura, so when Imam al-Sajjad was writing the treatise on rights and the supplications, Islam, as we sort of know it now, it had really sort of been, it was being destroyed, it was being hollowed out. And so really, so it's like a bit like an empty shell. The danger was it would just turn into an empty shell of performing some prayers and having sort of no real sort of deeper meaning. And so obviously what Imam Sajjad was doing, what all the Imams do, is to, in a sense, link this to the actual mission, link this to the Quran, to safeguard this, because obviously the what can we say? So Islam, so the message in Islam is very deep, and it permeates everything. There's no such thing as a shell of Islam. Islam is the core, and Islam is everything outside of that as well. And this is really the huge work. And without the Imams, so without, for example, Imam Sajjad at that point in time, that would have disappeared.
Yes. Ziyara Aminullah is from him too, isn't it?
Yes. Ziyara is another part of the discussion.
I mean, because, sorry, nowadays, just look, every Muslim, every Shia Muslim, when pays the visit, pay the homage to the holy tomb of the Shia Imams, one of the texts is Ziyarat Aminullah.
Ziyarat Aminullah is very important. Okay. Yeah, you may even dedicate one whole episode on Ziyarat Aminullah.
Yes, okay.
I want to talk about a misunderstanding about the life of Imam Sajjad.
Yes.
Might be that, well, after Ashura, Shia Imams put aside politics altogether.
Uh-huh.
This is wrong understanding.
This is wrong.
Because political campaign is not just war.
Okay.
Imam Khomeini has a line which is very good. He says that the crying for Abu Abdullah alayhi salam, shedding tears for Abu, is a political tears. Ashki siyasi. This is political.
It
has a political
right.
message. So by keeping alive the memory of Karbala, like having majalis of mourning for his father, and also ziyara, paying tribute and kind of reviving your allegiance to the Imam. The ziyara is completely different. I mean, we can discuss how it helps develop the spiritual bond between people, the person and the Imam. Being an event that is participated by many people, like the Arba'in, like in Najaf. So the ziyara has even more political message in it. So people who think that political campaign means just uprising in a hardware sense, no. The Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, in all of these steps that he took, he wanted to keep the message of Ashura alive, especially in keeping the memory of Ashura. Like in every occasions we have in the reports, like in every occasions, he would find a pretext to remember and remind people of Karbala. Like, for example, he would see water, he would remind people that they killed my father when he was thirsty. He would see different things. And this is actually as I said, Imam Khomeini says, the tears for Karbala is political tears.
That's right.
I walk in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get
Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was given the title Ibn al-Khiyaratayn, isn't it?
Mm.
The son of the two bests.
Mm.
And this is what Imam al-Baghir talked to him. And when he was asked why, he said that because he's from the two of the best of the clans, of the possible clans of all times. One of them, Quraysh, and the other ones is the Ajam, which was the Persians. We can't say wrong. Because we know that the mother of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam was Persian, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, yeah.
So, I mean, these might have a role even in establishing the Shia thoughts in the Persian lands. And when today, you know, when, because most of the time the Persians nowadays in the media are accused that you were born after the Safavid era or something like that, okay? It has deep historical roots.
Yes.
In the history of the world.
The historical context is this, that the Amawids were very racist.
Yeah, okay.
Even in the Ashura, is a manifestation of Amawids not understanding Islam as a global message, but a tribal fight that we have to win.
All right.
Even after that, they took everything. Racist people are like that. They see everything through the lenses of racism.
Mm-hmm.
So we have reports that the second caliph had told people keep the Amr, which means keep the governance among the Arabs.
Yes.
So they had this policy that the rulers should be Arabs. And they were very much oppressing the Ajam, non-Arabs,
yes.
Meaning Babylon, Persians, okay. Other conquered
yes.
lands.
Yes, yes.
So this would create animosity.
Uh-huh.
Ahlul Bayt, on the other side, they would tell people that the message of Islam does not have anything to do with any race. It's a global message for everyone. That's very important.
Yes.
That's we have two types of Islam. The type of Islam that is promoted by Amawids, who took the message of Islam to be something they own. Like sometimes in Jewish tradition you see this. God blessed them. They thought that God is blessing an ethnic group. God was blessing them because of the belief and faith, not because of their blood. So some Arabs at that time, they twisted the message of Islam. In contrast to that, Ahlul Bayt wanted to show people that no, the message of Islam is not a local message. Is a global
okay.
message, and everyone can participate, and you can see this in some symbols.
Mm-hmm.
One of these symbols is this,
yes.
The marriage between Imam Hussein alayhi salam and Shahr Banu,
yes.
And the celebration of this marriage by
yes,
Imam
yes.
Baqir ibn al-Khiratayn, that
yes.
we are not saying that it's only Arabs, even
uh-huh.
Persians can. And in later Imams also you have
yeah,
that the mothers
the
of the Imam
African continents,
yes,
that's right.
So that's the global
yes.
nature in Shiism.
Very good.
That would welcome everyone,
really
even at the level
yes.
of Imamah, at the level of Imamah, not just the followers.
Yes.
So by mixing the blood, showing that people,
mm-hmm.
you should get out of this racist mentality. And if you want some signs, these are the signs, but these are not even important.
And
the
social reform on that time, Imam al-Sajjad freed so many of the slaves of the time through his own money.
It's not just freeing, it was a process of training,
yes.
empowering.
Okay,
these
okay.
slaves, they did not have any privilege, they did not have any education.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Sajjad would buy them, train
yes.
them, teach them, and enable them to have their own independent
okay.
life, and then release them.
And Sister Zainab, this freeing of thousands of slaves comes hand in hand with writing a book, Risalatul Hughuq,
mm-hmm.
which is a treatise on the rights of the people. Very much modern, okay? I do want to say that so many of the freedom seekers nowadays in the world are after a pamphlet or something to show them that what are their rights. So Imam al-Sajjad did it on that time, practically speaking and theoretically speaking.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually quite an amazing book. So, because in there, and this is, let's say, 1,400 years ago, roughly, something like that. And he's as you mentioned before, he's listed rights for so many different groups of people and almost entities. So, for example, he even has employers and employees' rights. I think he has sort of the rights of a debtor over the and so everything, and then obviously the rights of different sorts of parts of the environment. And this is quite unique. So if people who, for example, work in, let's say, who have an interest in the environment, so and this, you know, for a couple of decades has been sort of, and it's still talked about, though it's sort of disappeared a bit because we've got something very important, the genocide, to be talking about, really. But when we look at this, the way Imam Sajjad has sort of compartmentalized all these different rights for the different things that are created by Allah. It's quite amazing because we can find everything in there. So in a sense that, and I think I myself have talked about the fact that, you know, if we have an animal in front of us that is obviously suffering in the heat, we should give it water. So the little animals have rights on us. So it's quite unique, and I would definitely say it's really good reading for non-Muslims to just dip into this and see.
Just have in your mind that the father of this imam we are talking about was brutally assassinated. So something that comes to my mind is that how much different these two looks are, the Umayyad ones and the Husayni ones or the Hashimid ones, okay? Mm. From one side, you have only revenge. From the other side, you have only rahmah, only mercy, okay? I mean, he could be after taking revenge. Mm. He could be after, for example, talking, I don't know,
writing something, Rasalatul Intiqam, for example. Instead of writing the episode on revenge, he wrote the episode of rights.
Yes.
So the contrast is sharp, as you can see. Yes. Actually, his father, I think the true word is that he was lynched. He was killed in a brutal Qatl al-Sabr. So everybody else would be traumatized to the level that they would lose their balance for the rest of their life. But you see that. No, the institution of Imama is a different thing. So they have their message to be delivered, and they deliver it in a best possible way. And
the next Imam, Imam al-Baghir, the son of Imam al-Sajjad, who was nurtured and tutored in such an atmosphere, okay? Wow, like an explosion in terms of the science and the knowledge. Baghir al-Ilm, okay? He's splitting the knowledge open. So that must be something. I mean, this is not... all of a sudden out of blue, or for example going to university, this school of thought or that. No, he was nurtured by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and all these as we said corpus that are being created, whether in terms of ziyara or whether risala or whether we can say sahifatu sajjadia or the works of supplication, have direct role in shaping the character
it has something to teach you at personal level that some bad incidents you can invest in them and turn them to the push for positive changes. Some people, when they have the first failure in their life, they just get despair and they start doing something that is not positive. But then at this level, still the imams, I mean later generations of the imams, are saying, no, this did not stop us. Actually, this become a kind of inspiration for us.
Motivation.
To convey the message in a different way to later generations. Yeah.
Really beautiful. That's right. Thank you, Sheikh Hussein and Sister Zainab, for a nice elaboration regarding Imam Sajjad's role and how he changed supplication and worshipping into a kind of a spiritual resistance. It was very kind of you. And thank you much to the listeners. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. Our new podcasts and live sessions are also uploaded over there. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted, 'cause I know that one day suddenly this this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me. You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab, and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flowers. Come on, walk again in our traveled streets and lanes, and heal the sky.
When you take action, there must be an internal coherence to your action, like stealing a statue of the State of Israel's first prime minister, or damaging a picture, a cultural artifact of the British colonization of Palestine.
Shortly after we started, we saw an escalation in police tactics against us. It was to stop us from speaking out. It was to stop us from acting. It was to stop Palestine Action from growing.
The way that the Palestinian cause was policed, the way that direct action for Palestine was policed, was at a wholly different level. To be thrown to the floor by police, violently arrested, showed to me exactly what the state thought about Palestine.
I think that was one of the main things that led me to take action. A woman called Mariam Afifi. I watched her being put in handcuffs, and she was smiling at the camera, and that was inspiring for me. I think that was one of the big reasons why I felt like taking action in Birmingham. So we hit a factory in Birmingham. The company was Arconic, and they're an aluminium rolling mill. they're controversial for more than one thing. They make parts for the F-35 fighter jet, but then there's also Grenfell Tower.
On the 14th of June 2017, a fire spread across the building, and because of the arconic cladding, it moved up, down, and around the building, and killed 72 people.
Whilst the action's happening, you know, it's fundamental to remember who you're doing it for and who you stand by whilst doing it. I was remembering, you know, stories of people from, you know, from every floor in the Grenfell Tower.
We wanted to show solidarity through actions, not just another statement, but by targeting the company which was both responsible for the murder of people in Grenfell and in Palestine. The same company which disregarded human lives in Britain are the same ones who supplied the materials for Israel's F-35 fighter jets used to massacre people in Palestine, in Lebanon, and across the Middle East.
So the arms trade connects Britain to the ongoing genocide in multiple ways. First of all, Britain is a part of the F-35 program, which is the NATO program, supplying warplanes to Israel.
Now, over 15% of every single F-30 fighter jet is produced in Britain with components made by UK-based arms factories.
UK is in violation of a number of its international obligations when it's exporting weapons to Israel, including the duty to prevent genocide, the duty to cooperate towards ending the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the duty to protect the Palestinian people.
So the directors of arms factories across Britain that have been targeted by Palestine action have often tried to distance themselves from kind of responsibility for where those arms are ending up. Now, what we managed to find at Declassified, based on hundreds if not thousands of cargo documents that we obtained, is that there are various factories across the UK, many of which are either Elbit or subsidiaries of Elbit, that they have been exporting to Israel amid the Gaza genocide. So what we've managed to do basically is to prove in real time which arms factories in the UK have been exporting to Israel, despite repeated denials on the part of the directors of the arms factories.
Is that on? So this, we understand this to be the roof that gives us access to the clean room where they make parts for the F-35 clean, F-35 fighter jets. So we believe that if we can contaminate this room, that we can put this factory out of action for up to 12 months. It's fine.
Whoa!
Jesus. Oh my word. There we go. Is it too much?
As we saw the genocidal campaign escalate, so our actions needed to match that in terms of severity. People started to break inside factories regularly. More people were coming forward and saying, I'm going to do it. And they were literally getting inside these factories and causing millions of pounds worth of damage.
Criminal damage to prevent a war crime is not a crime. When you put that before most juries in this country, they will see that for what it is, that these are people doing what they can within their means to try and prevent the greater harm.
We were allowed by our judge to talk about Palestine and to talk about and to put in front of the jury how drones are used to share export licenses from UAV tactical systems to Israel. And it means that you get a fair trial. When juries get to hear the whole truth like that, they, generally speaking, find people in Palestine action not guilty. Yeah.
after the genocide escalated in Gaza, we saw the increase in state pressure against Palestine Action. Actionists were being raided every week, of different homes were being searched across the country by the police. We knew at the start of Palestine Action, the state would do everything possible to try and stop us before we drove Israel's weapons trade out of Britain. And we weren't going to let them win.
Through freedom of information requests, we've been able to establish as fact that there has been constant coordination and meeting over the years between Israel, Elbit Systems, the British government. You then have the case of 2022, Priti Patel at that time as Home Secretary, meeting with the director of Elbit, Martin Fawcett, and talking about Palestine Action. In that meeting, Priti Patel told him, "We cannot directly intervene in the judicial process, but we have been in contact with the police about this." Within a month of that meeting was the first conviction of a Palestine Action activist. The next meeting that took place between a British government minister and Elbit Systems also included somebody representing the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, this is very likely to be a violation of 2.1 of the Crown Prosecution's Code of Conduct, which says that they must behave in an independent and impartial way without political pressure.
The fact that arms companies can and are able to go to the government and to lobby them directly to say impose harsher sentences on activists is in itself very telling of where we are.
Elbit Systems presents Lanius Search and Attack in One. New innovative autonomous lethal solution based on racing drones. The Lanius conducts GPS navigation, flight scanning, mapping enemy detection, and lethality in a complex urban environment. Equipped with AI technologies that allows navigation to building, scanning the building to identify openings, scanning and mapping, object avoidance, enemy detection and classification. Lanius, search and attack in one.
To tell you for sure that I haven't talked to anyone in Gaza or heard any recording in Gaza in the past year where I didn't consistently hear the voice of a drone at whatsoever at any moment.
The IDF has been systematically using drones in its campaign in Gaza over the past 16 months. These drones have been used to bomb civilians.
Israel and Israeli corporations are now marketing that as very effective ways of killing.
They're emitting sounds such as women or babies crying in a kind of perverse attempt to lure Palestinians out of their homes to tend to the person who's crying, and then using them to bomb them afterwards.
So first of all, we've had testimonies from doctors who were in the grounds who described direct bullets coming to children through these quadcopters. We've also heard accounts of pregnant women who were targeted by quadcopters, and also targeting of journalists.
So Israel is kind of at the cutting edge as well of drone technology. By way of its experience of testing these different forms of drones on a captive population in Palestine.
What I think I found particularly disturbing was that a bomb would drop maybe on a crowded, tented area, and then the drones would come down and pick off civilians, children, and we had description after description. This is not, you know, an occasional thing. This was day after day after day, operating on children who would say, "I was lying on the ground after a bomb had dropped and this quadcopter came down and hovered over me and shot me."
The Filton 18 undertook an unprecedented operation, they are alleged, to to have caused over £1 million worth of damage to that facility.
I think it's important for us to understand that when we're told Filton is a research centre, it's absolutely not that. It homes, it hosts killing machines. This is machinery that is created on UK soil with UK state complicity and investment that is targeting and killing innocent children and civilians en masse on a daily basis.
Fatima Zainab was arrested on the 6th of August. That's one day after she turned 20. Fatima Zainab has always been an advocate for social justice. I would say that's one of her most defining character. And when the genocide started in October 2023, it had a massive impact on her. We'd be going on every single march as a family, all the national marches, the emergency protests and rallies, we would be in all of them. And I think there came a point where Fatima Zainab was getting really distressed and very helpless that, you know, we're marching week in, week out, the government's not listening, our voices are being unheard. I feel this is the point where she felt that she needed to take action herself, do something more than just marching week in, week out.
And it's an incredibly difficult time because we're not only having to deal with the grief of witnessing a real-time genocide take place every single day, but on top of that, we're having to deal with the absence of our loved ones because they have tried to do something to stop that.
We're all proud of her, you know, we're all proud of being where she is for why she is in prison, you know, and even, you know, when I visit her, I tell her you need to hold your head up high because you're not going to allow anyone to criminalize you because you haven't done anything that you need to be ashamed of.
Now, the police response to this action has been quite extraordinary. They've used counter-terror legislation to detain and remand many of those activists in prison, and to the extent that they were moved from one site to another site without anybody who knows them being made aware that they had been moved, they're effectively rendered incommunicado from the rest of the world.
You have seen people detained on remand for a long time, but initially under counter-terrorism legislation, which meant there were numerous ways in which they could have more harsh treatment justified, supposedly in a cell all day with the lights on, all night with the lights on, regular disruption.
And with Fatima Zainab, I couldn't see her until 3 weeks into her arrest. The government has abused the use of counter-terror powers to arrest the Filton group, to interrogate them day and night. And then because of the terror connection that they're now labeled with, the consequences in prison, on remand, have been horrific for all of them.
It is safe to say that the worst legal framework to use in such a case is the terrorism framework. The terrorism discourse has been heavily critiqued by justice theorists, by human rights lawyers, by being a way to evade the rule of law and creating an otherwise called exceptionalist space outside of the law into whatever annoys the government.
The state realised that imprisoning people had failed to stop the movement. They realised that raiding people's homes had failed to stop the movement. This was the first time we had seen the state try and say that these actions could amount to terrorism. And despite being arrested under the Terrorism Act, none of them were charged with terrorism.